This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Past three evenings we've had together, we've been looking at the, if you will, general foundational questions and approaches to these questions that you can find in the Christian community today. Some of that may seem a bit pedantic, a bit tedious to get through, but it should be clear to you that if you don't know what the options are, and if you haven't made up your mind on these foundational questions, you're going to be very hard-pressed to give a consistent and well-grounded answer to the detailed, if you will, more juicy questions that we get into when we come down to matters like the separation of church and state, welfare, the enforcement of morals, capital punishment, war, revolution, etc. And we will not get to all of the issues that we named in the course syllabus because it is just taking time to do the others. But I would like to talk about at least three, perhaps four of these issues tonight before we break. What I'm going to suggest is that we hold questions to designated stopping points in the lecture. I don't prefer that method of lecturing, but because I will not see you again, this is one of these do or die situations. So I think it'd be best to let me get out a block of material and then get questions, a block of material and questions, rather than stopping mid-sentence and all the rest. Okay, the separation of church and state then. What are we to say about the separation of church and state? The first thing is the ideal that we are seeking, or at least it is my own opinion that we should be seeking with respect to the separation of church and state. We are seeking the ideal of a free church and a free state. A free church within a free state, where, of course, freedom has been properly defined for both. A free church within a free state. Now, we must distinguish between three logically separate questions which commonly come under the rubric of church-state issues today. As we noticed in the past, people often talk about rights. And when they do so, they fail to distinguish between freedom rights, benefit rights, and then if you've read my book on homosexuality, what might be called non-discrimination rights. And the very fact that people do not reflect on the distinction between these three, even though the same word is used, makes them easy prey for equivocation when they get around to engaging in some kind of reasoning about the question of rights. Because it turns out that the logical relations and the concepts involved in these three are very different. Okay, the corresponding duties for these various rights are all different kinds of duties, and consequently, the word rights may be the same, but the concepts are all quite different. Now, the same sort of thing happens when we talk about, quote, the separation of church and state. The separation of church and state is a broad concept, and it really covers at least three logically distinct issues. The first issue that it covers is papalism versus Erastianism. Papalism is the idea that the church should dominate the state, that the pope holds two swords, the sword of the church as well as the sword of the state. So papalism would represent the idea that the church dictates to the state. Erastianism is just the opposite. It's the view that the state, in some senses, the moral authority over the church and can dictate to the church. Okay, so under the question of separation of church and state, somebody can be asking us whether we hold that the church is dominated by the state, Erastianism, whether the state is dominated by the church, papalism. If you will, this is an institutional question of preeminence. Okay, an institutional question about preeminence. Now, when that happens to be the question up for discussion, and somebody says, well, my attitude toward that issue is the separation of church and state, or I believe in the separation of church and state when it comes to institutional preeminence, what that means is that the church ought not to dominate the state, and the state ought not to dominate the church. Okay, so somebody who believes in, quote, the separation of church and state, on this institutional preeminence question, is really saying, I refuse to let either be preeminent. They are coordinate institutions. Okay, so you have church and you have state. You don't have one over the other. Now that's just one of the church-state issues, however. Secondly, you can ask the question of establishmentarianism. There are those who believe in the establishment principle of religion, and those who believe in what is called voluntarism, establishmentarianism versus voluntarism. Those who hold to establishmentarianism believe that churches should be given state financial support and approval. They believe in a church state or state-approved churches, usually one church state, like the Lutheran Church in Germany or the Anglican Church in England, but it can be a multiplicity of churches, all of which receive support of the state, so that if a church is to receive monetary assistance, it must be state-approved. All of those positions come under the rubric of establishmentarianism, where a church is given financial support and approval by the state. Now, those who hold to the voluntarist principle believe that churches should be supported not by the coercive taxing measures of the state, but the churches should be recognized and supported only voluntarily by individuals, and thus voluntarism, the idea that individuals voluntarily support the church of their choice. Okay, so now this is not a question about institutional preeminence. This is a question of favoritism among denominations. Now here, if somebody is saying, I believe in the separation of church and state, what he's saying is, I am a voluntarist. I do not believe that the state should support the church. I do not hold to the establishmentarian principle. Okay? He believes in disestablishmentarianism. And that long word that you learned how to spell long ago finally comes into your vocabulary. Now you understand how it's used. A disestablishmentarianist is usually a voluntarist, okay? Somebody who believes in voluntary support of the churches. Somebody who believes in separation of church and state, when this issue is in mind, then is a voluntarist over against the establishmentarianist. However, in our own day and age, somebody who says he believes in the separation of church and state can be thinking of a third issue, one that has not traditionally been considered under this question of separation, and that is, if you will, the question of theocracy versus pluralism. A person who believes in a theocracy in some sense, as I am now going to define the word can be used in a lot of different ways. Somebody who believes in a theocracy believes that the state's moral obligation is through the law of God. The state's moral obligation is through the law of God. Theocracy does not stand for the idea that there is no separation of church and state. It doesn't stand for the idea that the church should dominate the state. Doesn't stand for the idea that confession of faith must be enforced by the state. Theocracy, pure and simple, means the rule of God. And of course, God rules by means of his law. And so if the state is bound to obey the law of God, morally bound, morally obliged to obey God's law, then that situation is called theocratic. Now, over against the theocratic ideal, you have those who hold to pluralism, that the state's direction is purely determined by popular opinion, apart from an objective moral duty as understood by some religion. That the duty of the state is determined by popular opinion, apart from an objective moral duty as understood in some religion. Okay, the theocracy versus pluralism. Now this is a question of moral responsibility. Are you seeing what I'm getting at? It's the way people equivocate when they say they believe in separation of church and state. You know, that could mean any number of things. And if when you remember how confused people can be, even when it comes to the one issue that they may be addressing, the separation of church and state can mean just an infinite number of things. Are we talking about institutional preeminence, favoritism among denominations, or moral responsibility? Now, in the past, it has turned out that in the literature that informs American political theory, Those who have written in favor of the separation of church and state have meant that there is no institutional preeminence. They have believed that there should be no law that establishes a religion, and on the other hand, there should be no law that prevents the free exercise of religion. So there's going to be, if you will, no institutional preeminence. And they have not held, in our country anyway, that there should be a state church. Now, I must qualify here, because in the United States, where disestablishmentarianism is the prevailing opinion, at least in the days of the founding fathers of this country, their view was that the federal government ought not to establish a state church. When the United States Constitution was ratified, and for a number of years thereafter, there were state-established churches in the individual states, at least in some of them. Okay, so that Anglicanism, or the Episcopal Church, was the established church in Virginia for a number of years after the Constitutional Convention and the ratification of the Constitution. Now that historical fact alone has got to be remembered when people talk about the fact that we will have no state church in this country. The Constitution's statement about the separation of church and state has to do with no federally approved denomination. It does not prohibit the states from having a state church. Now, maybe you feel that there ought not to be a state church. I happen to feel there ought not to be a state church. But as a matter of historical accuracy, whether I like it or not, the U.S. Constitution does not rule out a state church when it comes to the local states. However, it does rule out a state church on the federal level. The federal government will make no law establishing religion. Okay. Now, the establishment of religion previously had nothing to do with moral responsibility. In fact, there is a long and indisputable and clear history of Supreme Court decisions in this land where, as part of the majority judgment of the justices, it is openly declared that this is a Christian nation, and therefore the morality that governs the decision of the court will be Christian morality. Now, those kind of statements, you see, made by the highest legal interpreting body of this country, has got to tip you off to the fact that the modern polemic about church-state separation, when that arises over against those who believe that abortion should be ruled out or believe this or that moral issue should be recognized by the state, people who are using that language are in fact engaging in deceptive tactics. Now, in the case of some people, it is deception born of ignorance. I don't mean to say that that necessarily makes it innocent. I happen to believe that when you're engaged in public debate, you should know what you're talking about. And so that ignorance is a culpable ignorance. But on the part of others, there is the use of this language of church-state separation in terms of the previous connotation. We Americans all believe in church-state separation, but applying it to an issue that the founding fathers, the Constitution, and for many years, the history of legal interpretation, would not support at all. That is that any idea of distinctive Christian morality informing the court has got to be ruled out because there must be a separation of church and state. That there can be no distinctively Christian moral influence in the school or religious influence in the school because there's a separation of church and state. Okay, you begin to see then why it is important that we distinguish these three different questions of church-state separation. Now, this is a good place for questions.
Yeah, you just got done saying about the state makes no law establishing religion,
which is to say giving favoritism to one denomination over another.
I guess what I'd like to ask is, do you see a danger that our country may be heading that way from the repercussions of Jonestown? There was, I don't know if they've actually introduced those, but the rumors were that some senators in Congressmen were thinking about introducing those to try to curtail, for instance, establishment of cults in this country because of what happened at Jonestown. And I think the consequences of that could certainly affect Christian church, and I just wondered if you'd like to comment on it.
Yes.
Do you have any opinion about it?
Apart from a clear and present danger that arises from some religious association, there is no way that a law could be thus established in this country without violating the Constitution. The First Amendment of our Constitution recognizes and guarantees, protects the free exercise of religion. Okay. Now, I don't happen to believe that when somebody is engaged in virgin sacrifice in a satanic cult, that that is the free exercise of religion. Okay, you begin to see what happens if you believe there is no moral responsibility arising from the idea that a particular religious code informs the values of the Constitution. Because then anybody who wants to engage in any crime, what if somebody is a racist and he says, well, actually, that's part of my religion. That's just part of my religion. And somebody says, ah, that's silly. There's no such religion. Well, then you see the state has to go into the game of defining what is legitimate and illegitimate religion. Well, the minute the state starts defining what is legitimate and illegitimate religion, it's doing the very thing that we're told Christians may not do in terms of influencing the state. Having a legitimate religion, a legitimate moral standard, be upheld by the state. It's unavoidable.
They've already done that in the case of the one church that uses marijuana in their religious service or anything, and they deemed that that was a legitimate religion and they were allowed to use it. Though,
are you saying they were or were not?
They were using it, and that's of course against the law to use it. But since that was a religious practice, they allowed them to use it.
Okay, I'm not clear on the facts of that case, and so I won't offer any commentary. The point here is that if there should be a law introduced to curtail cults, it will have to be not because of the religious side of the cult, but because of the clear and present danger they represent to human life, or to perhaps brainwashing, or whatever the danger is, it will have to be justified in that way. Okay, now we could get involved in a discussion of American politics and American legal history, and that will be fine. I'll put an end to it at some point. But now as Christians, we want to ask ourselves, where do we stand on the separation of church and state? And I want to say something that is true in principle. It's not true as to matter of fact right here and now. But I want to say something that's very important, as I find there are Christians who have just not thought through this issue. It is conceivable that what the world means by separation of church and state, that we as Christians do not believe in the separation of church and state. Now, again, I say that is in principle. As a matter of fact, there are views in the secular society around us of what it means by separation of church and state. We do believe. I hope you do believe. But there is nothing sacrosanct about that language. There is nothing in the language itself that guarantees that we, whatever separation of church and state means, we've got to be on the side of those who believe in it. It may very well be that those who believe in the separation of church and state mean by the separation of church and state, there should be no churches in the state, anywhere. Now, we as Christians would not believe in the separation of church and state. So that any church is going to have to be outside the boundaries of the United States because we believe in separation of church and state. And everything that is the land here in the United States is state. I mean, that would be absurd, as you recognize. My point is, by using an absurd illustration, that it all depends on what content is being filled into this idiom right here. It all depends on what conception is being used when somebody addresses their conception with the language of separation of church and state. And I would say now more particularly with respect to number three, that when somebody is using the language of separation of church and state to mean the state cannot be brought to its objective moral responsibility as understood in the Christian religion, I do not believe in the separation of church and state. But of course I happen to think that anybody who uses that language is abusing the phraseology. Because there's a great difference between saying that the state should not be dominated by the church and that the state should not be dominated by Christian moral responsibility. You see, church and moral responsibility are different things. And as a matter of fact, it's quite conceivable, in fact I will argue in a moment, that it is a biblical conception that God, who of course gives us our moral responsibility, that God himself is the ruler over both church and state, and that God is the one who says there must be, if you will, a separation between church and state. That the agencies of the church, the means by which the church pursues its goals, and the means by which the state pursues its goals must be different. One uses the sword legitimately and the other does not, and that the aims of the church and the aims of the state are different. One being that of promoting the gospel, and redemptive reality, and the other the promoting of justice. And so that the separation of church and state means the separation of two institutions, the separation of two moral duties, however, both being subject to their responsibilities as defined by God. Okay, so that I do not believe in the separation of church and state, if you mean by that pluralism, that moral responsibility is defined by a majority vote of the populace over against the objective moral responsibility given by God. But now, having said that, let's make sure we don't commit another confusion. The fact that our moral responsibility is objectively determined by God and His Word does not mean that when the Christians are in a minority, they can then insist upon their way in the state. It may be true that the way we enact laws is through majority vote, but what should govern our attitude toward how we vote with respect to these laws must be that objectively given by God. And in a day and age, in a country where the Christian influence is dominant, the vast majority of citizens will vote in a way pleasing to God, and therefore by majority vote, the objective duty of the state will be recognized by the objective majority in the state, and the state will then do what the Bible says. But in none of that, you see, is there a breakdown of the separation of church and state, a call for revolution, or anything of the sort. We can skip just three full pages of notes. It's amazing how some professors do that, isn't it? Okay.
I wondered if you can make a comment about what's happening out in California in regards to the state trying to silence the churches for, quote, speaking out on political issues such as homosexuality. Some of the things that are happening there.
Yeah, although it has been withdrawn, as I understand it, the threat was for the last year or so in the state of California that churches could lose their tax exemption. There's a certain standard form that a nonprofit organization like a church has to fill out every year, a report made to the state, and that the state conceivably could withdraw the tax exemption of a church if it had been taking, quote, political stands, as understood by the state, of course. So that if a church or a school happens to be teaching that homosexuality was not a civil right, or that there ought to be laws against abortion, then of course that would be a political stand, and since the church or the school were taking, as defined, a political stand, they would lose their nonprofit status and their tax exemption. Okay, that's the situation. Are you asking for a comment on it? It stinks. That's my comment. As a matter of fact, the church, whether it has a tax exemption or not, is called upon by God to speak out on matters of public morality. Okay? And it is wrong, I believe it's wrong for the state to tax the church in the first place. And to say that the church must be taxed because it's not really a church if it takes political stands, when that's understood as matters of objective public morality, is just to oppress the people of God. It's really a way of trying to stifle opinion.
Didn't they take over some of the church property out there on those various reasons?
I have heard that story. I've not seen confirmation of it.
On that same line, I understand there was a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union in New York State, and I think in a federal district court there, trying to strip the Roman Catholic Church in the United States of its tax exemption for its anti-abortion stand. I don't know if it's been dropped or what's happened. I don't know. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I'm fairly certain it has not been adjudicated because I think I would have heard it. I mean, not that I hear everything, but those sorts of issues usually come to my attention. I have not heard of any such judgment. Carl, have you?
I think I've just heard the preliminary thing that was being started, but I imagine it's been a very preliminary type of thing. But I did hear that such an effort was being made.
Dr. Bogus has been, in the past, a denominational chairman of a committee having to do with abortion, taking a stand about its moral status, both within the church and the state, and that's why I thought he might know. Yes.
What do then say to Christians applying to positions of leadership to government? Say a Christian becomes the president of the state. So which thought do you use?
Which?
Yeah, two thoughts.
two swords?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, when the man is wearing his presidential hat, he should use the sword appropriate to the presidency. And when the man is, if you will, engaging in the act of a private citizen as a Christian, he should then use the sword appropriate only to a private citizen who is a Christian, the Word of God. A man who is the president of the United States, or a senator, or a congressman, or the mayor, or what have you, a man who is a Christian is also a politician, is in no different position as to moral responsibility on the job than is a Christian plumber, or a Christian farmer, or a Christian merchant, or a Christian father, or a Christian mother, for that matter. While we can distinguish between being a plumber and being a Christian, the fact is that a Christian plumber is going to do work in a certain way. In the most obvious sense, he's going to do it honestly. He's going to put in a full day's work or a full day's pay. He's not going to cheat people. He's going to make good on his work and that sort of thing. It's probably likely that he's not going to be doing plumbing work for houses of prostitution also. Okay, he will choose where he will work and where he will not. He's not going to work in areas that are going to favor open immorality. Now, just as there are standards governing Christian plumbers and Christian farmers, for instance, if I'm a farmer and I have hired hands that come to help take in the crop, I'm going to pay them a fair salary. And that's both the Old and New Testament require that we're going to, I'm going to treat them fairly. I'm not going to be harsh toward them. On the Sabbath day, I will allow them to rest. I'll not make them work 7 days a week and oppress them in that way. And so on and on and on we could go. There are moral obligations lying upon farmers and upon plumbers and upon fathers and mothers. And lo and behold, there are moral obligations that lie upon politicians and statesmen. So that when a Christian is a statesman, then the way he goes about his work as a statesman will be governed by the Word of God. And I should think that that would be one of the reasons that people would want to vote for him. Okay? He says, look, you have to know what my standards are. This is representative government. What kind of person do you want in the White House? Do you want a person who happens to believe that it's perfectly all right what kind of sexual life he has in private? A person who doesn't care what kind of tax structure he brings on the people? A person who doesn't care, you know, with respect to matters of war, what the principles of just warfare are? Or do you want a person who says, no, look, my principles in these areas are defined by the Word of God. People elect a Christian president, I think they should expect Christian moral standards to be brought to bear by the president. Now, Christian moral standards for the presidency do not include trying to use the office of the president as an evangelistic tool. Okay? The office of the presidency has nothing to do with profession of faith or acts of diaconal welfare within the church and that sort of thing. However, it is the case that being a Christian president calls for taking a stand for the proper penal sanctions of the Word of God, and the proper duties of self-defense in the government, and so forth and so on. I think it is far better that we have a non-Christian as a president, a professing non-Christian who believes in doing the things which we as Christians say Christian presidents should do, than having a professing Christian president who won't do the things that a Christian president should do. Now that may sound strange, but that's what the separation of church and state means. It means the moral duties, no matter who recognizes them, are the ones that we want to recognize in our leader. And although it is anomalous to have a man who is an unbeliever want to do believers' social, our civil ethics, if that's what he says he's going to do and that's what he consistently stands by, I'd rather vote for that man than to vote for a man who says he's born again but will not do what the Bible says when it comes to statesmanship. And so if that helps by that extreme example.
A lot of flack was created when Carter tried to, Whitman, was the president of Korea, or when he was over, was it Korea, was it Vietnam? But anyway, one of those countries, there was a lot of flack because they were saying, you know, that wasn't his job, that, you know, but in a sense, as a private citizen, he's got a right to witness as much as anybody else.
Sure, and that's what Carter should have said. I don't think his press strategy at that point was all that effective. If I were him, I'd simply say, look, I not only have a formal relationship with this man because we are both presidents, but I also have a personal interest in this man because we're friends. And as a friend and as a private citizen, I have a right to talk about on my own time what I want to talk about. Now, granted, it is difficult in some ways to distinguish what is your own time and what is the state's time when you're the president. Any time, of course, you could declare war at any time an emergency could arise. But certainly we grant the president has his private moments. We certainly want to say that when he's having Sunday dinner at home with his family, what he talks about at his table doesn't have to be governed by presidential politics. And likewise, when he has a visiting dignitary, he has the right on his own time, as friends, to talk about what he wants to, even religion.
I wanted to go back to the outline a minute and see if I couldn't get a point of clarification. Like with, for instance, item one, the papalism versus Erastianism.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to scholarship that would attempt to say, well, it's okay that you make those dichotomies, but institutional preeminence regarding church and state could also come from a third source, and that what they would define as civil religious tendencies in American society, or in a given society, civil religion as a source of that kind of preeminence rather than some kind of particular dichotomy. So they would argue that people who would be papalistic would be just as guilty of that.
You mean people who are guilty of promoting a civil religion are guilty of papalism? That's what you're trying to say, right?
Or that, well, what I'm saying is that there wouldn't really be the dichotomy, but that if there is an institutional preeminence, it exists because of what you would define as civil religion.
Well,
people like Robert Bella, to say one scholar who writes under the topic a lot,
yeah,
tend to have some hard drugs. I was just wondering how you would respond to that kind of scholarship.
I've read a good deal by Bell, and I've read a good deal by Pierre and Lindar and other evangelicals who pick up on the same kind of language. And totally apart from my evaluative opinion on the matter, just from a philosophical standpoint, I have to admit that this language of civil religion stands for any and everything that a writer doesn't like. Okay? And consequently, when we use the rubric of civil religion, it's often difficult to determine what the boundaries and principles of that concept might be. Now, if a person is promoting a civil religion, I should think as a Christian, if civil religion is wrong, I would like to promote something contrary to what this man is promoting. But it's certainly his right to hold to a civil religion. It's certainly his right to try to get people to vote in the direction of civil religion. But it is not his right to get the church to dominate the state. It's not his right to ask for an institutional preeminence. And consequently, it doesn't seem to me that the existence and the abuse of civil religion, whatever that might be, has anything to do with institutional preeminence. That's all that papalism versus Erastianism stands for. It's whether the institutional church can dictate policy to the state. Now, conceivably, every evangelical church in the country might stand up someday and take a stand for a constitutional amendment prohibiting abortion, except perhaps under certain circumstances. That's the accepted approach to abortion. It's not my own, but I understand why people take that stand. Let's say there's a proposed constitutional amendment, and every evangelical church in the country stands up and favors it. Would that be the church dictating to the state? No, it would be the church promoting in the public at large the opinion that this is a good thing to do and hopes that when the public at large votes, the public will dictate to the state that we need a constitutional amendment. And so even such an illustration of 100% institutional support for a public policy such as anti-abortion would not amount to the church dictating to the state. It would still amount to the church promoting an opinion in society at large. Now, on the other hand, you could have people promoting civil religion in the society at large. That still wouldn't amount to an institutional preeminence over the state. It would just amount to a false and rather materialistic and base religion being promoted in the state. Now, as we have it, the state itself promotes a religion, I believe, the religion of humanism, the religion that man can be his own God, the religion that we don't have to take God into account, if nothing else. The idea that God is the subject, that there are some areas of human endeavor and thought which are neutral to the idea of God, the existence of God, the standards of God. That in itself is a very definite and insidious religious opinion, and yet the state promotes it very often. And so there you have civil religion of a sort too. state-inspired humanistic religion. And so I don't believe we're going to get away from the idea that some religion is going to define the moral standards by which the state rules. It could be civil religion, it could be humanistic religion, it could be Roman Catholic, it could be evangelical. And as I see it, part of the Great Commission is our job is to edify the nations so that they observe whatever the Lord has commanded. So the prevailing opinion in our culture will be evangelical opinion. Let me start at a logically minimal level. Let us assume the legitimacy of public schools for the time being. Now then, let us say that in a non-coercive way, a teacher in a public school wishes to provide opportunity 10 minutes a day for the reading of the scripture and prayer. Okay, not that every child from every home, Buddhist, atheist, what have you, has got to read the Bible and pray, but that if the child wishes to, the child may. Or the child may leave the room, or the child may pray to Allah, or the child may, you know, do tic-tac-toe, or whatever, but this opportunity is there. And now people argue that violates the separation of church and state. Well, I think that argument can be very clearly lanced. I think that we can put an end to that, the validity of that kind of thinking, when you consider the fact that this is not coercion of religion, where it is a matter of being within the religious tradition of this country, and that the Supreme Court itself has stated that this is a Christian nation and all the rest. I don't believe that a very good case can be made for removing the Bible from the public schools where it is under the circumstances that I've enumerated, made an opportunity for a student to make use of that in prayer. Now I want to take it beyond the logically minimal level and add something else to it. If you believe in public schools, if you believe that the state has the right to finance and run schools, then in a real sense, you are asking for this kind of problem. You're asking for this kind of problem because what you then have done is you've said it's all right to the state to use the coercive power of the sword to collect money to run schools, which of course are always going to be a matter of controlling thought processes, what is learned, how it is learned. And secondly, you're letting the state use the coercive power of the sword to enforce attendance in the school. Okay, now if you give those kind of rights to the state, by the way, once those rights are granted to the state, then I think it's just a matter of time before the state starts asking for just about every other kind of right and every other kind of decision to be made. But nevertheless, if you grant that right to the state, then you have to remember that the people who are taxed include not only Christians but atheists. The people who are taxed include not only Christians, but say Muslims. Now, if the people who are using their money to finance this school, coercively, to be sure, but nevertheless, if their money is going into this school, then you can hardly consider it legitimate for them to get by and think that one religion should be favored over the other in the school. Why shouldn't their Muslim faith be given an opportunity during the day, too? If people want to play tic-tac-toe or pray to Allah or what have you, okay, but nevertheless, make opportunity now for a Muslim 10 minutes or that sort of thing. And all the more when Muslim children are being forced to go to the public school. So what I'm saying is anybody who believes that the state has the right to coerce money and attendance in that way, and it does so across the board on a populace that is religiously pluralistic, then they're asking for this kind of problem because it's a legitimate gripe on the part of those who are in the minority, the religious minority, to say, but our money and our children are involved. Okay, let me take it a further step beyond the logical minimal level and add to it that I don't believe the state has the right to tax for the sake of education, and the state does not have the right to tell me where my children have to be between the hours of 8 and 4 or 8 and 3, whatever it happens to be. So the state was never granted that right by God in the first place, and that contrawise the parents were given the duty to educate their children, so that what we should have is private education across the board, where Muslim parents get together and educate their Muslim children in the way they see fit, and Christian parents of religious stripes evangelical get together, and those of religious stripes Catholic and religious stripes Mormon and all the rest have their own individual schools paid by their own money. And there can also be humanist schools, just neighborhood schools where there's no religion taught at all, or so it is self-deceivingly thought, there is no religion being taught. And there, you see, when a parent has a child in the school and does not like what's being taught or how it's being taught or how discipline is there, the parent just takes the child out and puts him in whatever school he happens to favor. And then when the parent doesn't have enough people around of his own humanistic or religious persuasion, then he's got to learn to adjust his attitude to the available school. That way, nobody can complain. It's their money, and the teachers and the administration are answerable to the parents directly and all the rest. So now, in that situation, nobody can complain about the Bible being in a quote-unquote public school. Because by a public school, what we will mean now is not state school, we'll mean simply that it's open to the public. Have you ever noticed the vocabulary and analytical equivocation is the sort of thing I've specialized in my education? And that's another one of these things that, you know, really strikes me, that what used to be called public education still receives the honorary denomination public, when in fact it's become state. Public education simply means that we will not screen out any particular person. It's open across the board to the public. My own personal opinion about Christian schools is they ought to be open to the public. They ought to be public schools. I don't believe that racial attitudes ought to govern policy for who can get in and so forth. And I don't believe the religious conviction ought to govern policy as to who can send their children. Although I don't believe that unbelievers shouldn't be allowed to dictate policy to the school, that the unbeliever can simply take his child out if he doesn't like what is the declared and corporate stand of this school. So that, in a roundabout way, is my attitude toward the Bible in public school. I believe the Bible should be in public school, and I don't believe in state.
If a state, like the state of Ohio, was to get rid of all federal incursion of funds into their state school system, and the state of Ohio decided that as a state, it was going to approve Bible reading, this could be constitutional, right?
Sure. The state of Ohio has, now it will not be honored by the current Supreme Court, so I'm speaking anachronistically, but on the basis of historical precedent, in terms of what the Constitution means in historical grammatical context, and as it was interpreted for many years in this country, the state of Ohio has the right to declare that there's a state church in Ohio. So we will recognize, if you will, the Lutheran Church as the Church of Ohio. Not that others can't function here, but the Lutheran Church will receive state funds. It's conceivable, given the understanding of the federal constitution, they could do that. Now, if they could do that, they certainly could allow in the state of Ohio that in their state schools that the Bible could be read. All the more, they could allow it to be read in public schools.
Other questions on separation of church and state and education? Well, the one thing that you haven't asked, and I'm a little discouraged about, is what does the Bible say about this? I mean, we've been talking about one Christian's opinion, after all, and in a sense, I'm flattered that maybe you take it for granted I would have biblical foundation for this. But the issue, as I told you already, is not this language of separation or any particular concept, but it's the concept that is filled into the language and whether that is a biblical concept. So to round out the last few minutes of the lecture on separation of church and state before we move on, let me make a few points about the biblical conception of separation of church and state. There's a chapter in my book, Theonomy and Christian Ethics, that I've assigned you to read that talks about the separation of church and state. And in it, I argue that the separation, a separation of church and state, was recognized in the Old Testament. That in theocratic Israel, there was a difference between the cult and the state, between the temple and the palace, between the priest and the king, between taxation and tithing. But the difference between the work of Moses and Aaron, Nehemiah and Ezra, the tribal heads and princes early in Israel's history, the family heads, the elders, and later the judges, and then the judges with their judicial executive duties, and then finally the kings of Israel, were always set over against the cultic priests and the duties thereof. Now, one thing that sometimes confuses people is the class of Levites that we find in the Old Testament. And you must remember, if I can just brush you up on your Bible history, there's a difference between a priest and a Levite.
priests, in terms of those which were of the high priestly order, had to be of one family within the tribe of Levi, the Aaronic family. Other Levites were divided, the rest of the Levitical household was divided up into parties, some of which had direct obligations to the temple, and a few, a minority of which, had direct obligations to the civil court. In the courts, they amounted to teachers who interpreted the law for the sake of civil decisions. And so the fact that you see Levites in the courts does not mean that the separation of church and state was somehow broken down. That would amount to, if you will, a minister today offering advice to a judge as to what God actually is saying in the Bible. It's always up to the judge to decide whether that interpretation is binding on him or not. So the Levites were non-priestly, and they were involved both in the cult and in civil law, in the administration of justice. So having said that, notice also that Israel was unique in its own day in guarding the separation of church and state. Israel, in the midst of ancient Canaanite religion, in the midst of ancient Canaanite context, was doing something very unique, extraordinary. A king could not be a priest in Israel. In every other culture around Israel, the king was the high priest. The king was the supreme religious official as well in the society. In Israel, the priest was not the executive leader. In fact, in pagan religions around Israel, the king was not only a priest, he was often considered an incarnation of God in some sense. There was some kind of blending of heaven and earth in the person of the king priest. And so Israel, you see, in its day and age, was standing very definitely for the separation of church and state. I don't mean to say that what we understand in the New Testament as the separation of church and state is in all respects identical with the separation in the Old Testament. All I wish to say here is that those who say there was no separation of church and state in Old Testament Israel are not speaking something that will be true to the text. It's inaccurate to make that kind of general claim. Just notice the differences in Old Testament Israel. There was a difference between the officials of the cults and the state, between their duties, between the regulations upon them. Remember how Uzziah, the king, went into the temple to make offering to God, and he was struck with leprosy for breaking down the wall of separation, if you will. The requirements of the two, the priest and the king, were different. Their manner of succession was different. The location of their place of rule was different. Their servants were different. Their tributes were different. The penalties they imposed were different, and the personnel that made up these offices were different. What then unified cult and state in the Old Testament was not the different institutions, but rather the authority of God. Both church and state were subject to the rebuke of the prophet, because both church and state were unified under the authority of God. And so my conclusion, in terms of a survey of Old Testament political theory, is that the separation between church and state in the Old Testament was a functional separation. And there are many verses that we could turn to, but just for the sake of time, turn to 2 Chronicles 19, verse 11. 2 Chronicles 19 is where Jehoshaphat is appointing judges and rulers in Israel. And you'll notice in 2 Chronicles 19, 11, it is declared, "And behold, Amariah, the chief priest, is over you in all matters of Jehovah, and Zebediah, the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, in all the king's matters." There's a rather obvious and declared separation between the duties, the functions, of these two people. Amariah over the matters of Jehovah, Zebediah over the matters of the king. And then the Levites shall be officers before you. Okay, so here's in the Old Testament a declared separation between these two. You have one, the house of Judah, over the king's matters, and then you have the high priest over the matters of Jehovah. And so there is a separation of church and state in the Old Testament to be recognized. Now this separation is paralleled in the New Testament. The New Testament may add some distinctiveness to it. I don't want to preclude that possibility. But nevertheless, the separation that the Old Testament gives us is at least paralleled in the New Testament. The New Testament tells us that God ordains ministers both in the church and in the state. Nobody will deny that God ordains ministers in the church. Romans 13 tells us, quote, that magistrate has been ordained of God, and he is a minister of God. Moreover, the New Testament speaks of two swords, two quite different swords. One, the sword of steel, or sword of iron, if you will, that is used by the state, quite literally the sword, for he bears not the sword in vain. And then there's also the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. And these two swords are given diversely to the church and the state. 2 Corinthians 10:4 says, the weapons of our warfare are not fleshly. In the passage Ephesians 6:17, the armor of the Christian soldier, you'll find that his sword is the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. Jesus rebuked Peter in the garden for trying to use the sword to defend him. Jesus told Pilate at his own trial that because the kingdom was out of this world, his servants did not fight. Okay, another way in which the separation of church and state is seen, both being under the authority of God, is in Matthew 22:21. Jesus says, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, unto God the things that are God's. And as I've indicated, the coin belongs to Caesar precisely because it bore the image of Caesar. Okay, so you render unto Caesar the things that bear his image. You render unto God, contrariwise, the things that bear his image. Where is the image of God found? In all men. For all men must serve God. And then I think you'll find it of interest to note also in the New Testament, this is a fourth line of argumentation, that Paul could both appeal to Caesar and appeal against Caesar. Acts 25:11, you'll see Paul appeals to Caesar. He looks to the state for it to do its own proper work, and yet in Acts 17:7, we see that Paul appealed against Caesar, teaching contrary to his decrees, when Caesar violated the word of Jesus Christ. And so, in the Old and New Testament, you find a separation, a functional separation, of the two institutions, church and state, but you also find that both church and state are bound to the moral rule of God. Okay, I guess that I really am going to have to stop myself from going any further. I'd like to say more. Do you have any questions before I change the subject?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, in the chapter in my book, I think you'll find about it here. But it's not my opinion that they were. There are those who would hold similar Creonomic convictions with me who do believe that in the Old Testament that the Levites were supported by tax money. I do not believe that a good argument can be generated to that effect, although I'm teachable about that. You remember the school of the prophets and the controversy that arose in the Old Testament when there was somebody tithing to the school of the prophets rather than to the establishment religion. And the very fact that a controversy could arise there, that there was something inappropriate seen, nevertheless indicates that a person was free to do it and that tithe money, religious money, went to wherever faithful religion was being propagated in Israel. The establishment priests were corrupt in that day, and the school of the prophets were being, that school was teaching the prophets to declare God's will, and tithe money to go there. So I'm not convinced the Old Testament did support the Levites by taxation. I believe that was voluntary offer. That it was morally obligatory for people to tithe. But nevertheless, the state did not coercively back that up with the sword. But the state did back up with the sword taxation, which is to say, what supported its own function. As I understand what you're saying, I agree with it. I think, as a matter of fact, if the state does praise the church, that the hand that feeds does direct, and consequently that will always lead to, in subtle or explicit ways, the state determining what will and will not be preached in the church.
And consequently, we'd be far better to say, no, we don't want your money. We won't be as drug addicts getting used to the habit of taking from others like that and become dependent upon the state. So that when the state says, we're going to cut off your water after all, if you keep preaching in the way that you are about the sins of the president, no. Much better to have separation of church and state. In fact, I think you will be hard-pressed to find somebody who is as avid an advocate of the proper separation of church and state as myself. I get very worked up about that issue. Nevertheless, many people who have read my book, Theonomy and Christian Ethics, where I'm arguing the state has its own moral obligations to God, think that I believe in the breakdown of separation of church and state. I hope that tonight's lecture is at least convincing testimony that those two attitudes don't go hand in hand. Yes.
This question, he brought me to think about those who say, if this particular in this country, trying to cast against them, they are being supported by the state. Therefore, the candidate state, what the church is saying.
Well, that's just a confusion of thought. Exemption from taxation is a right the church has in light of the nature of its work, its profit, non-profit ministry. And totally apart from that, exemption from taxation is not to receive money directly from the state. And therefore, the state still doesn't have the right to dictate.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm saying, how would you counter that logic that's now being put forward and then folded?
I would counter that logic by saying that exemption to the church is simply a way of promoting social justice, indirectly promoting it. As I mentioned in my second lecture, that third option we had up on the board, that would be one way of favoring conditions under which nonprofit charitable organizations can thrive, but it's not a way of supporting directly and dictating to those organizations. And that as a matter of fact, the church and any nonprofit organization ought to be free of tax burden. We have become tax crazy in this country. I think that is an expression we can get used to. We think that the state has the right to tax just anything it wants to gain money any way it wants to. Okay? When the income tax was instituted in this country, you might be interested in the comments that were made on behalf of the measure to institute the income tax by those who favored it. They said it is inconceivable that anybody who is not wealthy in this country will ever end up paying income tax, because only those in a certain very high income bracket, I forget the exact detail, paid it originally, and they only paid 1%. Those who argued against income tax said, we really shouldn't have income tax because as much as everybody says it's impossible, the day may come where it will reach 5% of one's income. We live in a day and age where people hardly blink at the fact that just about anybody pays 20% of his money to the state now. For what? For the privilege of working for himself, after all. And those who do a very good job of working for themselves pay progressively harder and harder fines. So we live in a day and age where, the state taxes inheritance of all things now. When a man can't even pass on his substance to his children without the state saying, we have a right to that. You cannot buy anything without the state saying, we have a right to a portion of that. And the state has simply gone past crazy. And so it doesn't surprise me that people think that if somebody doesn't have to pay taxes, the state's doing them some kind of big favor. The question is, what are legitimate taxes? And who should be taxed? Okay, we're getting close to the time that we're supposed to take a break. I think this is well put an end to separation of church and state discussion, as much as we could go on and on. Each one of these, you can see how we really need a course that's much longer than a one-week wet-your-appetite approach to this. But I would like to begin the discussion of the enforcement of morals, the idea that some particular moral point of view should or should not be enforced by the state. In our next period together, and I'd like to get around to talking about welfare, too, if that is at all possible. So we'll break for 3 minutes.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, BonsonInstitute.com. where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.